science, learning, business, community. You. Welcome to Think Works, the podcast for people who like to think. Because thinking is the hardest work there is. Come with us on a journey into the world of ideas with your host, Darren Smithson.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of ThinkWorks, the place where we like to do all the heavy lifting when it comes to thinking. And this week I want to talk really about some of the concepts and ideas that are flying around, no pun intended, about the future of transportation. I think we're all aware of various different technological advances that are going on with self-driving cars, for example. Electric cars are now becoming much more prevalent. We've got the Hyperloop system that's been put forward by the likes of SpaceX and Virgin Hyperloop. And even Amazon are getting in on the act with using drones to deliver items. So let's look at each of those and also look at some of the human experiences. And then at the end, we'll have a little bit of a fun discussion that I'm going to keep under wraps until the end, because I have to keep you listening somehow. So bear with, but we will get to it, I promise. So let's look at some of those technological advances then. So autonomous cars, which are basically self-driving technology, which allows for vehicles to operate without human intervention. For example, the likes of Tesla and Waymo. The benefits are obvious. It's potentially safer, i.e. there'll be no rash human attempt to rush a red light and cause an accident. People not following the laws, the self-driving cars will stop at the right places and will actually make sure that speed limits are adhered to and so on. But also, if you're on a motorway where all the cars are self-driven, then there will be the right spaces apart and traffic will flow. And therefore, not only will they reduce accidents, it will also improve against congestion. So if the traffic's flowing and all the cars are able to regulate at a safe speed, then it will avoid bottlenecks because the cars will communicate amongst themselves, in effect, to make sure that they're all driving at a nice, steady pace so that congestion doesn't appear. Another benefit of self-driving cars that is not often discussed is also it gives extra accessibility to vehicles, to people who can't drive because they're physically or mentally unable to do so, but they are still, you know, they still want to get to places, they still need to get to places, and therefore they can still get there using a self-driving car. Now, there are some downsides to this, obviously. You've got high development costs, you've got to put in the infrastructure where the, because it's not just about the cars using the satellites in space to drive. You also have to have beacons that enable the cars to ping back and forth to make sure that they are in the right lane, at the right location, a precise location for them to be able to do their job safely. You've also got the fact that they could lead to huge job losses in the driving profession. So bus drivers, taxi drivers may suddenly find themselves not being able to be used. Lorry drivers, the whole idea of having freight on the roads, for example, there'd be huge losses in that particular industry. The biggest concern, of course, is whether or not the cars could be hacked and taken control of. When you consider the sophistication of hackers, particularly from an aggressive or pariah country who wish to do harm to another country, if you hack into those self-driving systems, you can cause a lot of damage and carnage and really bring a country to a literal standstill by jamming all the roads. And another factor to bear in mind is the legislation that could be passed. So California, for example, has got a legislation going through which promotes safety, but this very legislation can also restrict innovation. So some of the safety features and speed of delivery and price economics on some of these vehicles can be delayed because they have to keep taking into account the legislation that's being passed on a piecemeal basis, rather than a country or even the globe accepting that the satellites are in use. Let's have a global policy when it comes to self-driving cars. Now, electric cars are often tied into the idea of self-driving cars. Prime examples of that electric cars, of course, are Tesla and Rivian, but there are many more manufacturers now developing hybrids and fully electric vehicles. And yes, it's reduced emissions, it's lower operating costs and decreased reliance on oil, but you've still got the battery power problem, the battery disposal but creation, but also how expensive they are once a battery has reached the end of life. And in many cases, people are finding when they've bought a second-hand electric vehicle, they have to pay more for the battery to replace the battery a little later on than they did for the vehicle itself. And you've still got the problem with charging times and the limited range. And you've also got still the infrastructure, the charging points are not uniformly spread out, shall we say. So it can be difficult to maintain a vehicle on a long journey. But having said all that, there are incentives in Europe and the USA that are boosting adoption, but they do require that infrastructure investment before they can really become ubiquitous, before people can afford them, I think is the key issue. One of the most interesting ones for me in terms of transportation, technologically speaking, is the Hyperloop system. Now, you might have seen these in like Flash Gordon and various movies from the 80s in particular, but Pulp Fictions from the 40s and 50s. And the idea is that it's high-speed transportation using low-pressure tubes to transport pods at high speed. So it's almost like air itself is the propellant, and it pushes the tube, the vehicle that you're in, which is usually tubular, through these tubes at high speed. It's almost like, if you remember the kind of like internal postal systems before emails became popular, where people would drop a message in a tube and it would go through the departments and through the floors very, very quickly. It's just that kind of thinking. I find it fascinating. And companies are really investing into this idea. So you've got Virgin Hyperloop and SpaceX, for example. And the benefits are clear. It's rapid travel time. It's energy efficient, incredibly energy efficient. And it reduces congestion. However, you've still got very high construction costs. And there are still technical challenges about how do you make sure that the tube lets you arrive at the right location. And there's no regulation, there's a lack of regulation framework at the moment. And that can hinder development, but also, conversely, it allows flexibility. So Virgin Hyperloop and SpaceX are putting in a lot of the ideas around how they will develop Hyperloop systems and staying ahead of legislation that might hold them back until they've got something that they can do as proof of concept. And then you've got Amazon using drones and other organizations using drones for delivery. So aerial vehicles basically being used as delivery vehicles and delivering smaller packages. So Amazon Prime Air, it's got fast delivery times, it reduces traffic congestion and pollution. But there's privacy concerns, and you've also got airspace regulation issues as well. So the FAA regulations might ensure safety, but it does limit widespread use. They can only be used in certain areas. They are being used in certain areas, though, but it's not something that could be used across the country or across countries, I should say, because you've got concerns about the whole idea about the planes when they're coming in to land or take off. A drone might get in the way of that, but also privacy concerns, because of course drones have got cameras to enable them to go from A to B, and you've got them flying over people's homes or gardens, and people, you know, it's a legitimate concern. Now, in all of this, we've mentioned a couple of times about pollution and therefore sustainability and ecological impact, good and bad, of some of these initiatives. So if we look at that in more detail, so we could have energy obtained from natural processes and therefore continuously replenish, like solar power, like Lightyear's solar car, which uses solar panels to charge its battery, for example. You've got Norway's push for electric vehicles and the EU's Green Deal. You've got eco-friendly public transportation systems like hydrogen-powered buses that you see in the UK, in Germany and other countries. And this means that you are constantly reducing the carbon footprint and promoting energy independence. However, you've got initially very high costs of development. You've got technological limitations. It's all well and good saying that my car is solar powered, but in the UK you might only have one day in seven where the sun is actually shining because the weather is so variable. So you've got to factor in those kind of issues and the reliability, therefore, of these vehicles, especially if you're going on a longer journey, comes into question. Now, they are working on ways around that, and battery storage from solar power is improving all the time, but there are still limitations. And even the electric vehicles that you charge at standpoints, yes, the actual driving may reduce carbon footprint, but the actual building of the battery and the vehicles themselves is still a heavy footprint on the planet's ecology. So we've looked at individual developments and individual kind of pushes for innovation. But let's look at when you've got the whole idea of an urban mobility scheme that's being put into place. So, for example, you've got smart city initiatives, which we mentioned in an earlier episode of the podcast. So Singapore is integrating technology to improve urban infrastructure. And then you've got schemes like micro mobility solutions, which using small lightweight transportation options like Lime and Bird e-scooters, which are designed for short trips, and you basically rent them. So you go to a point where these items are, and then you use them to get to another point somewhere in the city that where you have these charging points. These micro mobility solutions obviously reduce congestion and reduce pollution greatly, but there's safety concerns. You've got also the idea that you can clutter sidewalks and pavements because you've got these points where you have to pick up the scooters and put the scooters back into a docking bay kind of approach it is. And therefore you're taking up space where people are trying to walk, and it has that kind of safety implication. People also drive these things like lunatics and use the pavements instead of the road. So you've got to bear in mind that people are not always sensible and indeed can occasionally show selfishness because they want to get from point A to point B quickly and they don't mind who they nearly knock over in the process. Another example is that bike sharing programs like City Bike in New York, and there's a similar scheme in some of the cities across the UK. It encourages exercise, reduces emissions, all good. But the downsides are the bikes get vandalized on a regular basis and it causes a high maintenance cost because you've got to, whoever's running and managing that scheme needs to obviously make sure that the bikes are maintained and safe. There's also some legislation impact, so some policies can support use and increase use, but they can also require significant infrastructure investment. Now, talking about infrastructure, we've got the whole idea about smart roads and IoT integration. So smart roads is basically, we've seen them on the motorways up and down the UK and other countries, where your roads equipped with technology not only to support electric vehicles and improve traffic management, like those in Sweden that charge vehicles as they drive, but you've also got the signs up telling you to go at a certain speed. It's kind of like if you look at the Swedish example, which the roads themselves are alive in a way and suit electric vehicles. And then you've got the UK's approach, which is the entry level, really, with the signs that say travel at 50 mile an hour or we take pictures of you. That's the simple version of smart roads, but true smart roads are the ones that Sweden are investing in. And the challenges of that is you have to upgrade the existing infrastructure. And when you look at how long it takes and the piecemeal approach that councils and the Department of Transport in Britain have, for example, with just filling in a pothole, then this looks like it's something, it's a dream, certainly for certain countries that don't want to put that investment in. But then in America, you had the infrastructure bill that went through, which actually put trillions into developing new road and transportation infrastructure. So that if you've got a will to do it, you can. But it also depends on how much money you're willing to borrow to invest. The Internet of Things integration that people are talking about is a system of interrelated devices that are connected to the internet, which enables data collection and exchange, such as smart traffic lights in Barcelona. So the lights themselves can manage the traffic flow and congestion. A very, very clever idea and very useful for reducing pollution and improving transportation times. But again, you've got that initial infrastructure cost that you need to do. You've also got cybersecurity risks, which we mentioned about the self-driving cars, and data privacy concerns as well, because these lights are monitored and controlled, and therefore they're not just monitoring the cars on the road. In effect, they see the whole scope of what they are looking at, which can be directly into shop fronts, houses, and so on. But once you've got schemes in place to actually stop that from happening, then you can, I think, really start to do, it's a minimal investment scheme that can have huge benefits in terms of reducing congestion and stress, and also improving the air quality of a city or town. And that brings us neatly into the idea of using policy and regulation to both encourage technological advances and new ways of thinking, but also to maintain safety and security and privacy laws. Now, all these need to be a fine balance in many ways, because you don't want to go too far one way and suddenly find that you've opened a real can of worms on in the other area of concern. But with most regulations, even if they try to achieve that nice balance, they still have negative impact of high compliance costs and complexity for companies, especially, as we said earlier, when legislation is done piecemeal. So states in America, for example, could all have different legislation initiatives. And across different countries, then you've also got those countries can be doing different legislation. You only have to look at the way that congestion charges have been rolled out in the UK. So there are several cities doing congestion charges, but all of them have implemented it in a different way and with different regulations. And if we're doing that, if we can't even get that uniform, what chance is there of having smart roads or safety devices or self-driving car frameworks that are the same across not only a country, but across different countries? I mean, in Europe, for example, if you're driving in a self-driving car and you're going from Belgium through France down to Spain, you've got an issue there because you're going into three different countries and they may all have different regulations when it comes to a smart motorway, for example. Now, all this starts to have an economic impact that can really derail, no pun intended, some of the projects that we're talking about. But it can also lead to job displacement. So, for example, you've got autonomous shipping now. So you've got the Yara Birkeland autonomous cargo ship. So there's no labour costs. It increases efficiency. It's got a minimal crew that are really there just to do maintenance more than anything else. And it does lead to big job displacement and also regulatory challenges. How do you regulate from port to port when you've got a ship that basically steers itself? This requires international cooperation, and let's be honest, one thing that the world is not good at is actually agreeing things internationally. High-speed rail projects as well, they reduce travel time and promote economic growth, but they've got high construction costs and huge environmental concerns. Just look at HS2 in Britain. I mean, we're useless at these big projects anyway because there's too many fingers in the pot. But I mean, it's billions and billions over budget and decade overdue, and it's still not going to deliver any benefit other than a few minutes earlier off a time between Birmingham and London. It's sometimes you have to think about the cost vs the actual benefit. If you're only going to shave minutes off a journey, what's the point? What we actually needed was higher capacity. So we needed new rail lines between the major cities so we could have higher capacity rather than just shaving a few minutes off it. The whole project was badly thought out from start to finish. And this is what we need to consider when people put these projects forward. Yeah, it might sound great on paper, but really, what were the actual benefits promised? Because we're not getting them. And we're certainly not getting them at the hundreds of billions that it's costing rather than the tens of billions it was supposed to cost. And the human experience in all this is frustration, because while we're putting this new infrastructure in place, we're causing delays and congestion elsewhere. And it's just stressful to travel to work. And I'm not being funny, but the last thing you need when you've got a stressful job anyway is stress getting to work and stress getting home from work. And all these things are not considered by governments and departments of transport and so on. And we need to actually really start to put the human at the centre of all these developments. How will it impact on us long term, medium term, short term? And again, play out the benefits. That said, there are some developments, technological developments, that have improved human experience. So the Uber approach, the Uber app, for example, giving instant access to any Uber driver that is in your vicinity, speeds up the whole process of waiting for particular taxi firms that may only be limited to a certain number of cars in a certain area and may not even go to where you want to go. So you've got the interface on this app is designed to make it as easy as possible. It's convenient and it's accessible, but it also leads to surge pricing, so it can be way more expensive than a traditional taxi. You've also got the data privacy issues again, because these apps are on individual devices and schemes, and they capture data all the time, which means that everyone using that app, from a driver's point of view, has got access to the data, your data. You've got Apple's CarPlay, which allows iPhone users to connect their devices to a car's infotainment system, which is great because it means that, you know, if you've got children in the car, that you can keep them entertained, which is fantastic. But you've also got the downside of it being distracting as well. So, you know, you're driving along, your child in the back loses connection all of a sudden from the system, and while they're complaining, you are distracted trying to deal with the children and work out what the problem is, and it can lead to accidents. There's no denying it. Now, there are lots of challenges and opportunities in across all these issues, but I think the main ones for me is basically the whole idea of cybersecurity. The more that we connect everything, the more that we connect devices and vehicles, systems and transportation and so on, the more likely it is that there are areas of vulnerability to exploit. As Scotty said in Star Trek 3, I think it was, the more complicated the plumbing, the easier it is to block the system. And he wasn't lying. I mean, it's so easy for these systems to fall over. Just look at the banking apps that keep falling over on a regular basis here in the UK, certainly. And I'm sure we're not unique in that. And it's not just when the bank goes down, everything goes down, because you've got suddenly shops can't do their tills, or people can't use the internet to order their shopping or to book a taxi. Everything seems to be interrelated now and just falls over at the drop of a hat, it seems like sometimes. So you've got all that. You've also got all the data privacy concerns, because we know that recently, for example, something like 6 billion passwords have been stolen from hacks that went across a whole range of different countries and companies, more to the point, including Apple and Google. And that it means that all that data is out there, and people are going to use that. They're going to use it to either sell on and get people an increase in cold calling, for example. But more importantly, you don't want them to use that to get access to your bank account. You know, it's just all these things have to be considered. And until companies can guarantee safety and security from hackers, then it's just the lie of constantly, oh, it's easier and more convenient. Do everything online. Do your council tax online. Do your council service request online. Do your banking online. That's great, but give me security, because if you're not, I'm still going to use cash, and I'm still going to use the phone and in person. And, you know, I mean, I'm a techno buff, but I don't trust these systems, because I've seen the vulnerabilities and how easy it is to crack the code, shall we say. And people just go along with it. We're not aware that we're sleepwalking into this. For example, the drive with banks and cashless society, and then you get the bank saying, oh yeah, but people are using 30% less cash than they did 5 years ago. What they're not telling you in that is that there are 70% less cash tills for you to be able to draw your money out of. And they're not telling you that stores have gone cashless, forcing you to actually use a card rather than cash. If I find a store has gone cashless, I refuse to use it. A restaurant, if it's cashless, I refuse to use it, because they're taking away my choice, and that is not right. And all these considerations need to be put in place, and people need to stop lying about the technological infrastructure that we currently have, because it is not fit for purpose. All that said, there are certainly some benefits to be had from the systems that we've talked about. And we need to look at these seriously now in terms of how can we maximise the beneficial impact while reducing the negative impact of many of these initiatives, including the self-driving cars, particularly on motorways, I think, where once you get onto the motorway, the car starts to drive itself. We need to be looking at how we successfully phase these in, so that we can reduce fatalities and accidents and improve the ecological impact of vehicles and transportation, and crucially remove stress and congestion from our day-to-day lives. That to me would just be fantastic. But there is one thing that we haven't considered so far in all this. Now, I alluded to this at the start of this talk about something that we will have some fun with. And I need to go back about 30 years now. And I used to do a series of talks called the ITU, the IT Update. And basically the whole idea was I would go into a company. I worked for a couple of companies at the time, but I would go into a client. They would pick three IT companies that they wanted to know what they were working on now, what they were planning on working on, and how it would benefit them. And they could be, you know, IBM, Microsoft, Hewlett Packard, just to pick three off the top of my head. So I'd go in and I would do those talks. But then at the very end, I would have a bit of fun. So I would put on some of the technological advances and projects and ideas and concepts that might be coming online that companies were seriously investing in and working on. And one of those was IBM's idea around teleportation. In fact, they were so confident that they would be able to develop a desktop teleporter at some point in the future. And I think they initially said 50 years in the year 1999, I think it was. They were running adverts for it in journals and technological journals and some IT journals. And I remember I did this one particular piece, 5 minutes at the end it was supposed to be, to a talk to CETA, which is not the BIN people in the UK, but it's the organisation that helps manage all the IT infrastructure for all the world's airlines and airports. And it was fascinating what happened next. So I did this 5 minute thing and it just broke out. These 5 minutes turned into nearly an hour of discussion because half the people that were in the presentation were like, oh, this is science fiction, it'll never happen. And, you know, it's just a nonsense. And then the other half were like, yeah, but 30% of our business is freight. What's going to happen if suddenly someone can just very cheaply press a button and send, you know, a box of cups from one side of the country to the other? So there's all this. It was a fascinating. I really wish we had recorded that entire, because it was an engaging conversation. You know, these people were taking it very seriously from both points of view. You know, there were some real brain boxes in that room. And the discussion was fascinating. It was absolutely brilliant. So when I started to do education talks, when I would encourage family learning, for example, in community centres and so on, I made sure that actually I talked about some of these fun aspects of what could be coming along in the future. And teleportation is theoretically possible, and this is what people need to get their heads around. And quantum teleportation is happening at a very small molecular level even now, because we have things like quantum entanglement. Now, this is not a physics lecture, but IBM and other companies have made significant advances in developing quantum computing. The idea of a desktop teleporter is, sadly, still science fiction at this point. Now, I need to be clear as well what we're talking about here. We're talking about inanimate objects. We're not talking about teleportation of a human from one place to another. The amount of information that would need to be digitally encoded in such a transmission would be ginormous, bigger than, you know, the age of the universe. I mean, it's just a ridiculous amount of information. And that is laying aside any spiritual conversation about the soul and consciousness. How does that get digitized and teleported? But we're talking really about, as I said, a box of cups on a desktop. You just press a button and off it goes. The idea is, with quantum entanglement, and this is, you know, people say nothing is faster than the speed of light, which is true, but at a quantum level, information can be transmitted faster because it's instant and it doesn't matter where these items are. All particles seem to be able to share information instantly, regardless of the distance between them. And so let's just say you've got two magic coins and they're entangled, and it means that no matter where they are in the universe, what happens to one will always happen to the other. So if it was two magic coins, let's say these particles were coins, so you flipped one of them and it landed on heads, the other one would turn up to heads as well, no matter where in the universe it was. So it's just an incredibly intriguing idea. But just think about that. If information can pass instantly across the universe at a quantum level, on a particle level, then how about if we've got enough energy to do it on a larger item, say, that is made up of those particles? And that's where the thinking is going with the development of this. And it just fascinates me that we can look at these ideas. Now, let's be completely clear. The only significant development that we are likely to see anytime soon using quantum entanglement as an idea is in the development of a true quantum computer. Now, that would be amazing because it would mean that you could have secure communication and advanced quantum computing that is so fast it would be really difficult for any hacker to be able to gather that information or break into that information that's being transmitted. And therefore, a quantum computing system, once it's reliable enough, could start to be developed to manage some of these self-driving or autonomous driving or transportation devices. Long way in the future. It's not even, you know, likely in my lifetime, rest of my lifetime, but it is something that could happen in the future. And I'm just determined. I want to see a practical use of a real quantum entanglement device. I think it would just be amazing. The whole idea of that was just to give you a little bit of fun at the end to see where these companies are actually investing money at the moment. IBM invested a lot of money into quantum entanglement and quantum computing, even though they haven't got a product to show for it yet. They have made significant advances, and other companies are doing the same. Because the first one, I think, that brings out a truly reliable and fully operational quantum computer and quantum network device are probably going to mop up quite considerably. And it'll be interesting to see where we go with that. And it will have benefits for transportation, as I've said, because these devices can be used to improve safety in self-flying planes, self-driving cars and trains and shipping. So, yeah, looking forward to that. I hope you found that interesting. There's lots of legislation that's coming on stream as well from states and governments across the world. So just take a look at some of that's coming along and see how it impacts on you and your particular locality, because you may be able to get involved and help shape the discussion around some of the legislation that's being put forward. As always, there will be a post for this particular piece. If you go to darreninform.com/ThinkWorks Forum, you'll see that there's a post. You can go in there and you can comment on your ideas about the future of transportation and what you would like to see. Yes, I know we all still want our rocket packs and our flying cars. That would be fantastic as well. But I'm really fascinated about the idea about the Hyperloop, and I think that could be something that would really suddenly make the future that was envisaged in the pulp eras of our publishing and TV and cinema productions. Just imagine it. Just absolutely amazing. But that's by the by. So take care, everyone. And I don't know what I'm doing next week. I never do until I sit down and think, what am I going to do on my talk this week? But we'll have another discussion then. But take care, and I'll see you all soon.
Would like to find out more or join in with the conversation, our forum has a corresponding post for you to comment in. Simply go to darreninform.com/thinkworksforum and join in the fun. Or you can join the Facebook page by searching for @DarrenInform for news, tips and other helpful strategies. The show was hosted by Darren Smithson and the music is by Alexander Nakarada. You have been listening to ThinkWorks, the podcast for thinkers.